Well, for everybody who's in here, welcome to the next session here. We're looking at session number 262, Author Meets Critic, The Lost Apostles, Forgotten Members of Mormonism's Original Quorum of 12. This is the book authored by H. Michael Marquardt and William Shepherd. Before we introduce the panelists, I just wanted to give you a reminder to please silence your cell phones in this session. Also, Lost Apostles, if you haven't had a chance to see it, is available at Benchmark Books table in the bookstore. Benchmark Books has kindly offered to donate a proceed of each sale to Sunstone. So if you're planning on purchasing this book, please go down there and buy it down to Benchmark's Books table. We also wanted to let you know we will be recording this session, so later on during the Q&A session, please keep that in mind that you will be recorded for the information that Sunstone makes public. A brief introduction of our speakers. H. Michael Marquardt is an independent historian. He's published in the Journal of Pastoral Practice, Restoration, Sunstone, Journal of Mormon History, John Whitmer Historic Association, Dialogue. The list goes on and on. He's the author of Joseph Smith's 1828-1843 Revelations, The Rise of Modern Mormonism, from 1816 to 1844, as well as the compiler of early patriarchal blessings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, contribute to Robert Rittner's The Joseph Smith Papyri, and author, along with Bill Shepherd, of Lost Apostles, Forgotten Members of Mormonism's Original Quorum of the Twelve. William Shepherd is the co-author, along with Marquardt, Lost Apostles. William Shepherd is also a past president of the John Whitmer Historic Association. And most people don't realize that William Shepherd was raised in the Strangite tradition, still attends a Strangite church in Wisconsin. Andrew Hamilton has recently finished his master's degree in counseling. He is an avid book reviewer. He recently published a review of The Lost Apostles, Forgotten Members of Mormonism's Quorum of the Twelve. That is available on which blog? Approachingjustice.net. If you haven't seen that blog, it's a wonderful blog. It's centered in Mormon theme, but it's a liberal politics blog. Definitely recommend it. Reed Russell is sitting in the center here. He's a retired illustrator from Hallmark Cards. Lives in Jackson County, Missouri, so the official Zion. And he is a avid book reader and reviewer as well. This time we'll go ahead and turn the time over to Andrew.
If any of you are science fiction fans, especially if you follow Star Wars or Star Trek or some of those kind of things, you may be familiar with the term fanboy or fangirl, which they often use for those that are really big fans of that genre. And this session might be better called Author Meets Fanboy, because I know that Reed and I are both big fans of this volume, and you'll hear a lot of good things about this book. It is very good. But since this is an author meets critic session, I wanted to mention a few of the things that I guess you could say I was critical of or disagreed with or did not quite understand in the book. The main point in the book that I found myself disagreeing with Shepherd and Marquardt was over their interpretation of why the original members of the Latter-day Quorum of the Twelve were chosen to be in that quorum. The traditional story given by Joseph Smith after Zion's camp failed to return the saints to Jackson County was that it was never God's intent for the army of Israel to return the saints to Zion. Rather, the purpose of Zion's camp had been to prove the men and try those who would be called to be the original Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. Shepherd and Marquardt have a different theory as to why the original Quorum of the Twelve was chosen. After describing the apostles' early missionary zeal and success, they state, "For the apostles, the fire of adversity was not Zion's camp, but rather the privations and persecution of the mission field. Selecting these seasoned missionaries also reinforced the importance to the church of proselyting and the purpose of the Quorum of the Twelve in spreading the gospel." In their chapter on Zion's camp, they discuss that 9 of the 12 men selected as apostles were in Zion's camp. 2 were waiting in Missouri, and 1, John Boynton, missed it altogether. Then they state, "The issue is not whether they did their part, but whether, as later explanation went, the march on Missouri was divinely designed as a boot camp for future apostles, testing their perseverance and faith. It does not seem to be so." Then one chapter later, in the discussion on the actual calling and setting apart of the 12, Shepherd and Marquardt put forth their position once again and state, Joseph was personally impressed by Zion's camp participants who had remained loyal to him through the adversity. Yet despite the pressure to succumb to Joseph's influence, the three witnesses disregarded this display of military zeal and drew instead upon missionary veterans, some of whom had not been in the militia. They gravitated towards men who were strong-willed and independent spirits who were forceful speakers. To me, this idea that some of whom were not in the militia does not make sense, since the chapter previous to this pointed out that 9 of the 12 were completely involved and 2 of the 12 were partially involved in Zion's camp. Only 1/12 of the quorum had no involvement, so they did not quite win me over to their argument on that point. And while I agree that the three witnesses gravitated towards men who were strong-willed and had independent spirits and were forceful speakers, this does not rule out the possible importance of their Zion's camp experience. I think that Shepherd and Marquardt have a good argument that the 12's missionary labors were very important and played a major part in their being chosen as apostles, and I agree that their strong-willed nature and their independent spirits and their ability as forceful speakers, as demonstrated on missions, played a role in their being called. I just do not see this as being the only role in their being called as apostles, as Shepherd and Marquardt appeared to in Lost Apostles. In fact, reading the book convinced me that both Zion's camp and their missionary labors played a role in their being called. There was one place where I really wish they'd have provided a little more information, and maybe they can today if they have it. On page 88, it discusses a time when William McClellan was on a mission. While traveling, he stayed one night at a Mr. Droon's house with Mr. Droon and his wife. McClellan had good things to say about Mr. Droon, but described his wife as, quote, a great slut, very nasty, unquote. After dropping that tidbit of information, they just move on. I would have liked a little more context for this story, if it's available. I mean, I know today what that charged word means and why it gets used, but what did it mean in the 1830s? Did Mrs. Droon make a pass at McClellan? Yeah, is there a little more going on here that we don't know about? It would have been nice to know the rest of that story. I also found the beginning of chapter 8 to be worded a little bit confusingly. It states, the loss of so many prominent leaders in Kirtland and at Far West, and I'm sorry if I talk real fast. I was a debater in high school, and fast is kind of how I go. I'll try to slow down. But it says, the loss of so many prominent leaders in Kirtland and Far West left a troublesome void that Joseph Smith could not fill during his incarceration in Liberty Jail. By the time he escaped custody in April 1839 and arrived in Commerce, Illinois, the High Council had approved the ordination of John E. Page and John Taylor to the Quorum of the Twelve, which occurred in Far West on December 19, 1838. Now, this makes it sound like Page and Taylor were called in Smith's absence and possibly without his knowledge and approval to become members of the Quorum of the Twelve. But Page and Taylor, along with Willard Richards and Wilford Woodruff, had been issued their calls by Joseph Smith in a revelation in 1838 that is now Doctrine and Covenants, section 118 in the LDS version of the Doctrine and Covenants. There was also one part of the story of Lyman Johnson that had me somewhat confused. Yesterday, Shepherd and Marquardt gave a great presentation on William Smith and the Notorious Hodges Gang, and Lyman Johnson, another member of the Lost Apostles' involvement as the Hodges' lawyer. The story is in the book, and you can read about it in the 250-page range. And it explains that Irvin Hodges of the Hodges' gang was murdered, likely by another gang member, returned Jackson Redden, in June of 1845, likely to keep him from talking to the authorities. Lyman Johnson was then tasked in September of 1845 with aiding the sheriff in arresting Redden for his part in the Hodges murder. Some of the individuals who were former members of the church at this time or were against the church had accused Brigham Young in this period of being involved in the Hodges events and helping to protect the Hodges gang. After telling the story of the arrest attempt and its aftermath in the book, there's a citation that states, Even William Smith wrote in the Sangamo Journal of November 1845 that Irvin Hodges was running at large in Nauvoo under the protection of Brigham Young. So I am not quite sure if this was a mistake and they meant to say that it was Return Jackson Redden that was being protected since Irvin Hodges was dead, or if they thought that Brigham Young was, if maybe William Smith really thought that Irvin Hodges was still alive. So I just hope they can maybe clear that up today. All right, now fanboy time. I'll tell you about some of the things I really loved about this book. Oh dear, and I'm already probably at my time limit, so I'll do this really quickly. So a lot of you like me, probably if you grew up in the church, you grew up hearing about how awful the people were who left the church behind, these apostates. Thomas B. Marsh was a favorite, right? Left the church over a pint of cream. He gave a disposition that caused the church to be kicked out of Missouri. I grew up in Provo, so this story was often added to with the fact that BYU would have been Thomas Marsh University if he stayed in the church, and Y Mountain would have been, Marsh Mountain or something kind of like that. And these men are always just treated as complete villains. They're one-dimensional. They have no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Shepherd and Marsh give us a completely new picture. They debunk the stripping story, which we don't have time to go into at the moment. They give us stories about Marsh's zeal as a missionary, about his dedication to Joseph Smith. They quote a letter from the time that he was supposedly this awful guy worrying about the milk strippings, where Mary Fielding Smith said, "Elder Marsh is a most excellent man. He seems to be a man of great faith. He says that he believes that the difficulties between the presidency and the 12 will shortly be settled." They quoted letters from Vallott Kimball as well, talking about what a great man that he was. They document that while he was defending Joseph Smith in Far West, his son passed away and he was going through great personal trials, but still managed to defend and stand by Joseph Smith through all of this. It was not until he became aware of the Danite activities in Missouri in 1838 and saw the depredations that they were involved in, saw them driving Missourians out of their homes, saw them doing these kind of things, that he began to be disillusioned with what was going on. And it was at that point that he felt that the church had gone astray and Joseph Smith was wrong, and because of his pacifistic feelings, that is when he decided to separate himself from the church. I just want to add that Shepherd and Marquardt have forever changed the way that I think about the lost apostles and about apostasy and apostates in general. As I was preparing my review, I heard a quote from an individual who said, "Apostasy deals with those who are traitors, who no longer are loyal to a cause that they have espoused or have an or to their covenants that they have entered into." This individual then provided a list of 10 reasons why church members apostatize and what we can do to avoid this. These reasons included criticizing the church leaders, being offended, being involved in persecution, a desire for wealth, having deep sins, especially the sin of immorality, and many others. After I read Lost Apostles, I realized that none of these things, with perhaps the exception of William Smith, who is a troubled individual, applied to these men who are the members of the early quorum of the 12 apostles. In fact, they state that these men had sound judgment and moral consistency. They remained loyal to Joseph through thick and thin when most other people would have long abandoned him. When some of them decided to break off their association with the church, it was not a decision that they took lightly. All my life I've been taught to look up to the pioneers and to look up to the apostles, but these people often come out as one-dimensional. But life is not one-dimensional. You can't break people down into cartoon villains and Mary Poppins, practically perfect in every way type people. Life is complex, and there's far more than 50 shades of gray in what we do. And the lost apostles that I learned about in this book are complex individuals that I can learn from in my own complex life, and I thank them for writing this book, and thank you for coming today.
Well, William Shepherd and Michael Marquardt have written a phenomenal book, and we owe them a debt of gratitude for a job very well done. And also a very big thank you to Signature Books. not only for publishing, but for selling the book on Kindle for only $9. I mean, are you kidding me? This mountain of research for just $9? And then the Kindle Matchbook. Are you aware of Kindle Matchbooks? I wasn't until recently. If you had bought Lost Apostles through Amazon, then they offer you the Kindle book for just $2.99, which I thought was also wonderful. So many great things to say about this book. Let me start by mentioning the amazing amount of research, investigation, and examination that is so evident in the book through its interpretation, examination of hundreds of sources. And I always smile when I see the notes at the bottom of the page. I hate flipping back to the book, back of the book. And so, thank you. Yeah, not having done so would have been one of my major criticisms of the book. The notes are not quite as handy on the Kindle edition, but still just a click away. The Herculean task of organizing all of this material has been done so very thoughtfully, thoughtful in the masterful sense. Shepherd and Marquardt make it look much easier, which is a pleasure for us as a reader, than I'm sure it actually was. Telling the story of one person in a first-rate biography is daunting enough, but telling the story of six individuals at the same time in such an organic flow really shows a lot of skill and proficiency. And for those not aware, it's not a chapter on John Boynton, a chapter on Thomas Marsh, a chapter on Luke Johnson. It's this organic flow through history. In chapter 6, The Collapse of Kirtland, for example, there is so much happening so quickly and with so many additional characters in the story that it would have been very easy for the story to quickly become very confusing and muddled, but Shepherd and Marquardt really kept a steady hand at the till. I kind of envisioned this long trail of index cards from one end of your house to the other with tangents going off here and there to keep that story straight in chapter 6. But above all, kudos to Shepherd and Marquardt for finding these lost apostles for us and helping us to understand and appreciate how and why they became lost. They write, quote, "We would very much like to correct the injustice we feel has been done to the memory of these men. What little mention is made of them is usually in the service of cautionary tales about what happens if you disobey the prophet, exhibit pride, or fail to follow the commandments." And then they give an example in the book that's kind of an ironic twist on this. When you visit the home of John and Nelsa Johnson in Hiram, Ohio, and I was there just a couple of years ago, so the experience is fresh on my mind. The missionary tour guides give lavish praise to John and Nelsa for the sustenance, for the hospitality, the service they provided to Joseph and Emma in a rough time of their lives in a sanctuary that was badly needed. We're shown the bedroom where Joseph was dragged out of to be tarred and feathered. We're told that one of the most famous visions in the history of the church was received there, and of the miraculous healing of Elsa's arm, etc. And the praise that John and Elsa are given is very well deserved, but what we're not told by the missionaries there is that John Johnson became a leading dissenter in 1837, losing his place on the High Council and dying outside of the church, and that Elsa, after John's death, remained alienated from the church for decades prior to her death. It's kind of the opposite of us being told in gospel doctrine, and we are every 4 years, and I think the story is also in the youth manuals about what a schmuck Thomas Marsh was. And instead of the praise that could be afforded him for the great works he did in the early days of the fledgling church, all of the facts in one story are relevant, and we are given them in this book. And in between the lines of the story of these six men is the story of a very rapidly growing church and a very rapidly growing Joseph Smith. These were relatively young men, some of them in their early 20s, trying to keep up for them with the ever-changing, ever-expanding mind of Joseph Smith proved to be confusing, mind-boggling, and a near impossible task. Young men dealing almost overnight with tumultuous issues like polygamy and sanctioned violence and financial greed. So this book is long overdue. Way too much time has passed since the details of the lives of these men have been told. Stories that are just not well known. Further, the book is well worth the purchase price alone for all of the details were given on the singular William Smith, Joseph Smith's brother. A real highlight of the book. How can you describe William Smith in just one word?
Huh?
Son of a. rascal, character, scalawag, opportunist, caustic and difficult, or just plain impossible. Yesterday, they mentioned that Paul Edwards described him as a wart on the ecclesiastical tree. Linda Newell yesterday in the session referred to him as just plain unstable. But as Andrew mentioned, we also learned that he was loyal, he was a true believer, and effective missionary. But the stories of William Smith really brightened up the book with a lot of color, humor, and human interest, very much appreciated. For example, they mentioned yesterday that William Smith, writing in The Wasp, the newspaper, took time just to tell us about how hideous Thomas Sharp's nose was, going into detail, everything wrong with his nose. And we also learned that William Smith, writing in The Wasp, referred to Thomas Sharp as Tom-ass. So, quite a character. So, just for fun, which apostle in the temple stood up and cursed Joseph Smith to his face while the sacrament was being passed? Which apostle, just a few days before Christmas, was crossing the Mississippi River on a horse-drawn sleigh and, along with his companion, crashed through the ice to his death? And which apostle had his marriage performed by the famous Reverend Henry Ward Beecher and then left on his honeymoon in a hot air balloon? The stories are all here in the book. I grew to like these men. I want to know more about them. And Bill was just mentioning that there is more about them, not just what they left on the cutting room floor, but what they have learned since. And I hope, Bill, that you take the time to tell us a little bit about that. We need to own these six men. They are part of our history. Their history is our history. We only gain from coming to know and appreciate their stories. So thank you, Bill Shepherd and Mike Marquardt.
This project would be impossible if it were not for signature books. So we sure thank those folks. After we turned in our manuscripts and it's too late, I started finding some of the neatest things that would fit in the book. Things about William Smith at Nauvoo. But let me concentrate on Thomas Marsh a little. in just a few months. He was a very, very humane man, good missionary, solid man. At Kirtland, after the first mission of the 12 apostles, he stands up face to face with Joseph Smith and says, "You're wrong about the way you're treating the 12 apostles." He was in Missouri in 1837, and he hears rumors. He is president of the Quorum, but he hears rumors the Quorum's going to go to England. And he rushes to Kirtland as far as he can go, as fast as he can go. And we don't know exactly what happened with when he met Joseph Smith, but he becomes a firm friend. He edits the elder's journal. He travels with him. He lives in his home. But when he is leaving, Joseph Smith, we believe, gave him a revelation to take to Zion or the far west. And this revelation said, Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, W.W. Phelps, John Whitmer are in transgression, and they may have to be disciplined. Once he arrives in Far West, a purge is going to start. In this purge, he is going to be the voice of Joseph Smith, cleansing the church of dissidents. So this is one thing we need to remember about him. We look at the positive things that we make him so popular, but we need to realize that it was the arrowhead. He is the one that set the process in motion by where Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, John Whitmer, and Lyman Johnson are excommunicated from the church. He is so sure the church needed to be purged. But within months, he sees something different going on. He sees a militancy, and he hears Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon talk about the coming war with the Gentiles and what we need to do with those dissenters. Why don't we put them on a horse and put them out in front of the battle? But he is kind of forced to go out into the field, and he witnesses some of the effects of Gallatin and Millport, and he is heartsick. And he comes back, and you know the story of going to Richmond and giving this deposition. And if you've ever seen the deposition, it is on the internet now. It will be on the internet. It'll be in anti-Mormon articles, as long as there are anti-Mormon articles, because he says that they are Danites among the Mormons. And he says that Joseph Smith told us that he is the second Mohammed. And you type that into the internet, and that will come up. So I guess the point is that with Thomas Marsh, a great servant, the sword of Joseph Smith, but his real impact is what he did to Mormonism itself. It's the fact that anti-Mormons will always grasp onto that. So anyway, I think as we look at him, we need to put that in the venue. As far as other people, we believe that we've opened a venue with some of these folks that needs to be told. And just in the last month, I've come across four articles, three in the Warsaw Signal, when Tom Sharp quotes from this wayward ex-apostle. And I just copied a 1871 history of Hancock County, and his whole deposition is prominently mentioned. So with that, we see again that we have opened a venue that we hope will be added to. We need a biography on Boynton, and maybe Michael talks something about that.
Yeah, I want to thank those who have commented on our book. One slight item relating to the choosing of the 12 apostles in 1835 in Zion's camp, just a small amount of interpretation. There were originally 8 members who had been in Zion's camp. Phineas Young was one of the first ones chosen, a brother of Brigham, to be an apostle. We explain in the book that Joseph Smith wanted his brother William to be there rather than Phineas. And, of course, William Smith had accompanied Zion's camp. Also, at the meeting of February 14, 1835, the first meeting relating to the apostles, they did separate those men who went to Zion camp. So they were seated in a certain part of the building. And besides choosing apostles, there were also some 70s who were chosen. And they were chosen that they should be ordained to the ministry and go forth to prune the vineyard for the last time, or the coming of the Lord, which was nigh, even 56 years should wind up the scene. And since completing the book, there has been some nice material on the Church History Library catalog. One example is a letter of Party P. Pratt to Azel Smith in July 21st, 1835. And this is in addition to what we mentioned about this conference in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. And we also, in the appendix, have early newspaper articles that actually mention the meeting of the full quorum of 12 in their conference there. And so this is a little additional material. Also, on the first apostolic mission, Jonathan Hale accompanied them at various times in 1835. And so the church has made that available in PDF, beautiful images of his journal. So there's still a lot to learn, but we hope that you enjoy the lost apostles that we've presented to you, and basically they're now found. Thank you.
One more round for our panelists, please. We have about 25 minutes for questions. It looks like the microphone is shrunk, so if you want to erect it, that would be great. Please speak into the microphone when you go up to it. You have to speak very closely in order for everybody to be able to hear you.
I'm convinced I need to buy it. However, I would like to... I was unaware that the Strangites were still around, and I was hoping that Bill might entertain us a little bit with some information as to how large the community still is, authority claims, what sorts of basic belief systems they still possess.
Well, of course we feel that Brigham was wrong. Now, there are about... maybe 100 Strangites left. It's in the spring of 2008 Journal of Mormon History, I have a large article in there about the concepts of rejected gospel. And Strangites would say that in accordance with 3 Nephi 16 and 10 and so forth, the gospel was rejected and that it would go forth at a future time to the Jews. So the Strangites see themselves as being a remnant with a valid priesthood.
I absolutely loved the book and I appreciate all the research you did. I found it absolutely mind-blowingly fascinating about Phineas. Is this on? Phineas Young being the first one called. Do I understand that correctly? And then Joseph Smith intervenes. He was not called by revelation to pick the 12 apostles, but he makes an adjustment. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Phineas was older than anyone else in the quorum, this means he actually would have ended up being in Brigham Young's place. I would be curious to know if you had any other information besides what was in the book, because that would have completely changed the trajectory of the church. It would have changed the succession crisis and if whether the saints would have gone to Utah and what was taught in Utah. So it's just so fascinating how you showed what a train wreck William Smith was. And we don't know that much about Phineas, but it sounds like he was a pretty good guy. And to have been the first one chosen would indicate he was a pretty good guy. So I'd love to know, you know, your take on how inspired Joseph Smith was in that decision, and if you have any other information besides, I think you only provided two documented references to that amazing historical event. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. The Wilford Woodruff Journal mentions Phineas Young, and he said that he was one of the first ones chosen for the quorum. Wilford Woodruff also mentioned, and it's not in the book, but he questioned that, whether that was really true. But we know that he was at the meeting when Oliver Cowdery's 1848 letter was read to the quorum. So over a period of time, maybe he forgot about that. As far as Joseph Smith wanting his brother William, the original plan, of course, was in 1829 for Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer to choose the 12. Well, nothing had been done over a period of 4 years. So by 1835, it was decided to add Book of Mormon witness Martin Harris. And so they chose the names, which at that time included Phineas. And then Joseph Smith thought that he needed to save his brother, so William should be ordained an apostle. And so we don't know too much more about that why, but through the course of the early history, you'll find that the early witnesses chose apostles. You'll find revelations that name apostles, and then, of course, a committee of the First Presidency choosing apostles.
Just on the irony of things, Missouri, the Battle of Crooked River, the death of David W. Patton, the leaving of the Church of Thomas Marsh, all of a sudden, who does that leave as third? Brigham Young is third in line. So just that fact.
I have a two-part question. The first, how do you feel these excommunications of these dissenting apostles has influenced the modern LDS church's stance on excommunicating apostates? And secondly, why don't we have or have not had a apostate apostle for so long?
Well, we'll skip the last one, but if you read the actual material, even though we say some of the apostles were excommunicated, a number of them have actually submitted letters of resignation, and that includes Oliver Cowdery, and includes Lyman Johnson. They're right in the history of the church. But, of course, then they hold a court. A lot of the problems dealt with Sidney Rigdon and Joseph Smith in Kirkland. And when they left in January 1838 to Far West, and they thought that they're going to get rid of those who had different opinions, they call them, you know, dissenters, and all of a sudden in the Far West, there are more dissenters there, and that's where Counselor Sidney Rigdon starts giving, you know, sermons like the Salt Sermon, the July 4th Oration, the organization of the Danites, and threatening those that don't agree. And that's why you would have the Whitmers who were excommunicated, and then like the wife wouldn't be excommunicated or the children, but the family would leave. Hiram Page's family would leave. You have actual families to leave just because there was, you know, disagreement. Some of the apostles were actually on the high council. You know, Thomas March was filling in President Pro Tem of the High Council. He was following the instructions in part of Joseph Smith, and they wanted these people out. These were brothers before. In fact, we mention in the book, for example, of Lyman Johnson and John Boynton in 1840 arriving in Nauvoo. And John Boynton had his wife there, and Joseph Smith was so happy to have them there. He thought he was going to have, you know, old members of the quorum coming back in. In fact, throughout this whole history of John Boynton, and I talked about that in one of our book signings at Ken Sander Books, when he came to Utah, he made two trips. They called him brother and sister. There was a bond there. But in Boynton's case, he basically wrote out Mormonism in his family history. He didn't want anyone to know that he was a missionary or a Latter-day Apostle or had ever been a member of the church.
While Rock is coming, you really would benefit from reading the Far West Journal. Read about the trials of these men. And it's interesting in there, somebody mentioned Phineas Young. One of the charges against Lyman Johnson is beating Phineas Young up till he had blood coming out of his ears, for whatever reason.
I had, in the Thomas Marsh's affidavit, he blames Joseph Smith for being behind the Mormon wars, but my understanding had always been that Samson Avard had created the Danites as a secret society without Joseph's knowledge. Is there evidence to show that Joseph was aware?
Well, first thing is that Samson Avard was not the captain general of the Danites. And you had the first captain general would be Jared Carter, and when he was replaced approximately July of 1838, it was Elias Higbee.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's following the constitution of the Danites. And one interesting fact as far as whether Joseph Smith knew about the Danites is that he attended meetings. There is a journal of John Smith, who lived in Adamum Diamon. And right after the rumors of the Election Day War that there was the one or two Latter-day Saints who were killed, which was not correct, Joseph Smith and the other two counselors of the First Presidency, Elias Higbee and Samuel Avard, rode together to Adamum Diamon. So he clearly knew about the Danites. He was not a Danite, but he knew. And the Danites were to support the presidency of the church.
Are you saying he attended at least two meetings? Joseph did?
Well, absolutely.
Well, I don't know anything.
Again, I believe we've opened a vista here. We don't see that our research is the end all. Hopefully people will really pick up on this. There's a great deal of work to be done out there, perhaps in the Missouri period, to try to better understand the forces that caused Joseph Smith to determine the church needs to be purged. And I wonder if that's not, when Joseph Smith is driven from Kirtland, I suspect he made a pledge, never again will I tolerate people in our midst tearing us down. So I think there's something to that.
You obviously have become very intimately acquainted with these six men. And I'm wondering, over the course of your research, who did you develop the most affinity for? In other words, who's your favorite and why?
The reason we got started up in our little Mormon church in Wisconsin, the LDS elders would come, and just nice young men. I'd always say, "Where are you from, Utah? Do you know Richard Bennett?" Or so, you know, as if somebody would. But to find somebody with historical knowledge. And one young man said, "Did you know Lyman Johnson is buried at Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin?" Of all places, that I knew who he was. I had no idea that he is buried a couple hundred miles from me. And just going over and finding his headstone, and his headstone being saying that he actually died 3 years later than Mormon history books say, I really learned to like Lyman. And Mike and I both went to the John Johnson home, and we both at different times, different places, and we both came away with, my gosh, those folks don't really know anything about the John Johnson family. And the John Johnson family, if you read about it, was devastated by Mormonism. And this John Johnson Sr., who has all this lavish praise that's mentioned, my goodness, he dies out of the church. He virtually becomes a pauper for what he has put into the church, for how he helped support the Kirtland Temple, and the sons and daughters that didn't accept Mormonism, and the ones that did that left, or Luke left coming back. So it just, that alone is the idea of, If that happened with John Johnson, what happened with the rest of these dissidents?
Lyman Johnson was actually one of the ones that became kind of a favorite of mine. One of the stories you might be familiar with from church history is many years later, Brigham Young supposedly reported on a speech that Johnson gave in Nauvoo, where he stands before the group that was then the Quorum of the Twelve. And among other things, he talks about since his leaving the church, his life had been nothing but darkness, pain, sorrow, misery in the extreme. I have never since leaving Mormonism seen a happy moment in my life. Talks about he wished he could cut his arm off if it would make it so he could believe in the church again, and some of these kinds of things. But the picture that these two men paint in the book is just completely different. Shortly after he left the church, Heber C. Kimball and Orson Hyde were returning from England and were with a group of members of the church going down to Missouri. He put on a dinner. You know, supposedly he's this horrible anti-Mormon at this point, but he puts on a dinner and invites Heber and Orson and 30 or 40 other members of the church, feeds them quite well and takes good care of them. He continued to do well in his life for some time. Two of his homes were large enough that they were considered landmarks in the areas that they were in, and one of them was later used as a bank. And until his wife died many years later, he actually did fairly good for some time and was just a fascinating man. And again, the stories you get over and over again are just so different from the ones many of us are traditionally used to. And it's nice to have this new picture of these men and what they were really like.
Got another question about Thomas Marsh. I've never quite understood what in the world possessed him to go to Utah and ask to be accepted among the community of the saints there. After all he'd been through, why would he go to Utah? And did he stay after Brigham Young humiliated him the way he did?
Hopefully they'll have a little bit to add as the experts, but the book paints a pretty good picture of him and what was going on. His wife had passed away at that point. He began to felt stirrings, I guess, that made him feel that maybe the church was true and he had made a mistake. And he, at great sacrifice, he walked and took himself to Utah. One of the fascinating differences, there's actually a video you can watch that kind of depicts his return to the church. And Brigham Young in this video is very nice to him and helps him up to the pulpit in the Bowery and is very kind to him. And which in contrast, after he gets up and gives his speech thanking the saints for allowing him to return, Brigham Young just mocked him unceasingly. Said, "Look at how old and decrepit and awful this man is. He couldn't find a wife if he wanted to, and I could get any woman in the territory that I want." And just really... was horrible to him and quite abusive, but you know, it's hard to say just what was going on in Marsh's head, but I guess maybe some of that old zeal he had had for Joseph Smith and for the restoration returned, and he wanted to do something about that and felt a desire to do that despite the fact that Brigham Young was quite awful to him.
Some may be wondering, okay, who were all these six men again? So it's Luke and Lyman Johnson, brothers, the sons of John and Elsa Johnson, and then William Smith, Joseph's brother, John Boynton, William McClellan, and Thomas Marsh. So.
We need to say a word about William Smith. He was one of the most difficult people, maybe one of the most awful people in the early church. It is very, very, very hard to like William Smith. Continually, he demonstrates terrible, terrible judgment. He would argue when he would be so much better just to shut up. He comes back to Nauvoo in March of 45 with his dying wife, stays there just a matter of months, but he burns all his bridges. He should have been smart enough to realize that Brigham Young was in charge, but yet he keeps dropping hints that he should be in charge because he, his brother Hiram, was patriarch over the church. William seemed to think, if I'm patriarch over the church and I have my apostleship, I should be in charge of the church. It's evident to me that if William Smith, who desperately wanted to have the security of being patriarch, he wanted to be able to take missions and charge for give patriarchal blessings. But he has to literally flee from Nauvoo, fear of his life. And he's going to hook up with James J. Strang. And he's going to be a loyal member maybe for a month or two, but then there's going to be these liaison with women, and he's going to be kicked out, and he's going to move on, and he's going to go from denomination, or if you will, organization to organization, but each one, there's going to be problems. And the problems is that he does not seem to have the ability to tell the truth, nor does he have the ability to bridle his passions. It's really strange to see this time after time, and there's going to be women involved, and there's going to be problems, and he's going to be kicked out, and the people he called brother, and this is the presiding high priest over the church, a month later he is condemning and ridiculing. And what he says about Brigham Young, for instance, he says, how did that go? He is the son of Ham, that he was actually born, he should be a Negroid or something. I mean, he is terribly evil and insulting to everyone that crossed him. And this goes on for year after year after year till the reorganized church gets going. And he approaches his young Joseph. And young Joseph has received a packet of information of his transgressions. And William would like to be an apostle. And Joseph is such an admirable man. But he says, no, don't think so. We'll let you become a high priest. And this didn't work good for a while. But yet, from the security that this gave William and some limited funds, he becomes a decent citizen in his old age. And he preaches for the reorganized church. When he says, I'm going to write this little manual of my remembrances, and Joseph III says, well, you don't need to talk about polygamy. So he doesn't, of course. And when he dies, the lawyer, the old judge that gives his eulogy, says, he wasn't like those other Mormons. He never indulged in polygamy. So
I think we'll go ahead and wrap up there. We've had some fantastic conversation. Do you have a comment? Go ahead.
I just did want to ask real quick if either of you have any more context for that William McClellan story where he thought that that man's wife was just so nasty. Is there a reason that caused him to speak that way of her?
No, we really don't have anything more. It was in, I guess, a shorthand in his journal. So it'll be of interest that maybe something else will come up of that. But McClellan kept that journal good, so there must be something to that.
All right, well, thanks, everybody, for attending. Thanks to our panelists. If you have any further questions, they'll probably be in the back of the room here while they set up for the next session. Thanks.